friends, welcome back to the podcast. I hope you're all having a good week. And I'm just going to start this episode by saying that this case is going to be focused on one of the most captivating and convoluted murder cases in Irish history. This case involves a very twisted love triangle, which sadly resulted in the murder of a very kind and loving man from County Tipperary, and it went on to become one of the longest murder trials in Irish history. So, buckle up and we'll get straight into it. So, this case is set around a dairy farm in County Tipperary, and I think, you know, it's very easy for us to underestimate the massive workload that farmers have, especially running a dairy farm. A farmer has to be a mechanic, a veterinarian, an accountant, a manual labourer, and a meteorologist, all rolled into one. And they have no days off. 365 days of the year, they have to work brutally long hours. You can't call in sick when you're running a farm. You can't decide, oh, I'm just going to skip milking the cows this weekend. The show must go on, no matter what day it is, no matter what weather it is. And that was the very difficult position that 52-year-old Mary Lowry found herself in when her husband Martin died. Martin had passed away in September of 2007 after battling with cancer, which meant that the family's 50-acre farm in Fonagowan was now left basically unmanaged, and Mary was completely overwhelmed by this task. She was now a widow, and her three young sons were relying on her now as a single parent. But, thankfully for her, Martin's very close friend and brother-in-law, 50-year-old Patrick Quirk, immediately stepped in to help her manage it all. Patrick had been close friends with Martin Lowry, and he was actually married to Martin's sister, Imelda Lowry, so Mary had known Patrick for years. They were practically family, and so she trusted him. Patrick Quirk had a farm of his own, but he also began farming on Mary's land, and he was helping her manage the finances and her investments. But by the beginning of early 2008, they had also begun sleeping with each other. Now, Mary, from early on, felt that this affair was very seedy, and she was ashamed to be sleeping with Patrick. According to her, the reason why it happened was, you know, on her part, she said she hadn't had a sexual relationship in a very long time, given the fact that her husband had been sick. And she felt that Patrick pressured her into the affair while she was still in a very vulnerable place after her husband's death. Now, it didn't take long for Patrick to sink his claws into her further. Pretty soon, he and Mary's finances were getting very tangled up together as well. In fact, Patrick used 80,000 euros of Mary's money in an investment. He also suggested that she should leave him 100,000 euros in her will so that way he could take care of her children if anything were to happen to her. Then he also borrowed 20,000 euros from Mary when his creditors demanded that he repay on his loans. He also took out a 7-year lease on Mary's farm, where he liked to keep his dry stock, while he kept his dairy herd at his own home farm in Brinchamore. He also demanded that she compensate him when he lost some of his cattle to bovine venereal diarrhea because, according to him, the cattle supposedly caught the disease from her late husband's herd. Now, it seemed to me like in this situation, Patrick had lined up everything in his favour. Now he had control of Mary's land, he was having sexual control over her, like they were in a relationship, and he almost seemed to want the relationship more than she did. You know, he was involved in pretty much every aspect of her life now, and he wanted to stay in control. Now, even though Patrick claimed that he loved Mary, she felt intimidated and overpowered by him. And like I said, from early on in the affair, she had been overcome with her own feelings of guilt. So her interest in Patrick was really, really cooling off. Then, when Mary happened to meet a new man named Bobby Ryan in August of 2010, it was like a breath of fresh air for her. And it kind of gave her the reason, I suppose, at last to finally cut the cord with Patrick once and for all. So Mary decided that she would end the affair with Patrick. They had kind of been on and off again, but now she was ending it for good, so that way she could be with Bobby instead. But by Patrick's own admission, he was not happy about ending the affair, and it wasn't an amicable split. But regardless, no matter what he said or did, Mary was certain she wanted to be with Bobby. She wasn't ashamed to be with him. She didn't have to lie and hide their relationship. Plus, Bobby was a wonderful person. He was sociable, he was popular, he was fun-loving, and he was kind. So let's talk a bit about Bobby Ryan, who is unfortunately the victim in today's case. Bobby Ryan was a 52-year-old. He was a father of two. He had a son named Robert Jr. and a daughter, Michelle, with his ex-wife, Mary. He and Mary had been married to each other for 19 years, but they decided to amicably separate from each other in 2005. They had drifted apart, but they had no bad feelings for each other. Like I said, Bobby was a popular, happy, sociable guy, and he was a popular local part-time DJ in the area, and he went by the stage name Mr. Moonlight. DJing was Bobby's passion. He really loved it. He loved getting a party going, and he loved seeing people enjoy themselves and having a good time. He would play great music like Tina Turner and ABBA, but the real reason that people wanted to hire him was because of Bobby himself. He made the party. When he wasn't busy DJing, Bobby worked as a truck driver at Killock Quarry. Bobby was a very hard worker, and he would get up early and work very long hours. But now, you know, he was in a new relationship with Mary Lowry. He realized he really cared about Mary, and she felt the same for him. Plus, her boys loved him too. He was fun, and the two of them shared a passion for music and dancing together. Now, I can imagine after the tragedy of her husband's cancer diagnosis and his death, Bobby must have been like a ray of sunshine for Mary. He was the kind of guy that no one had a bad word to say about. He had this like bright smile. You can see it in all the photographs of him. He had a bubbly laugh. He was a very loving dad, and his kids and grandkids adored him, and they all called him Granddad Bob. But by the end of 2010, Patrick, he still hadn't accepted that Mary was finished with him, and he was growing more and more suspicious that maybe she was hiding something or someone from him. And he decided to, you know, follow his suspicions, and he checked her phone, where he discovered her texts with Bobby. Now, initially, Patrick was furious about this, and he took Mary's phone and he used it to text and call Bobby, basically trying to break up their relationship and warning him kind of that, you know, he was the man in Mary's life and that she was going to be with him, not Bobby. Now, this would just be the start of Patrick's many attempts to break up Mary's new relationship, by the way. So Mary had to beg Patrick to get her phone back. And after that, she had to come clean to Bobby about the affair that she had had in the past with Patrick. Now, she was very ashamed about it, but Bobby stuck by her, and Patrick was devastated. He tried to manipulate Mary, and he tried to keep her in this kind of nervous attachment to him. He would like let on that he was feeling really down, and he would send her texts that suggested that he was suicidal. And so with all of this turmoil going on, Bobby actually reached out to Patrick and offered to meet up with him to talk about his own marriage breakdown and to try and offer him some guidance on how he could cope with how he was feeling and how he could cope with, you know, Mary leaving him and moving on. And that just shows like what a good-hearted person Bobby was. So Bobby met up with Patrick at Hayes Hotel in Thurles, where the two of them sat down and they talked to each other for about an hour, and they ended the meeting by shaking hands. But despite acting like he and Bobby were on good terms and maintaining that he had enjoyed this meeting, Patrick, in reality, was very unimpressed with Bobby, and he would later tell Mary that her new boyfriend smelled badly, and he even went on to tell her brother Eddie that he should warn his sister that her new boyfriend was just the kind of guy who wanted to go out late at night and get attention from other women. But regardless, Mary was a grown-ass woman who wanted nothing to do with Patrick, and he was so sick about that fact that she had moved on with a new man that he actually wrote a letter to a Sunday newspaper agony aunt column detailing the whole thing, the whole affair. Wait till you hear this. I'm going to read it out. So the article was like called, you know, you were writing into this agony aunt called Patricia. So the letter starts and says, "Dear Patricia, I've made a right mess of my life and I need help on how to go forward. It all started 4 years ago when my best friend died. This man was also my wife's cousin and a close family friend. He left with a wife and a young family after him. I coped by throwing myself into doing all I could for my friend's wife and children. There was much sorting out to do in relation to his business. Unfortunately, this led to an affair with his wife, and I fell deeply in love with her. It lasted 3 years and came to an abrupt end recently when I found out that she was seeing someone else. When I confronted her, she claimed that she had fallen out of love with me and was waiting for an opportunity to end us. This was a defining moment for both of us. She no longer depended on me and quickly forgot about me by putting all her energy into developing this new relationship. This man promised everything that I couldn't. She introduced him to everyone in the family, including my wife, and they were all delighted that she had found love again. My problem is that I am brokenhearted and angry at how well things have worked out for her, despite her lying and cheating on me. We met on a constant basis, as we have business connections as well as family connections. She refuses to discuss her affair and says that it is in the past. She has confessed it to her new lover, while I have no closure and am forced to carry this dark secret alone. I now feel a tremendous amount of grief and shame for a lost love and am possibly suffering postponed grief for a dead friend, all in silence. I know I have done wrong and let my wife down badly. I contemplated telling her, but I feel it would do nothing to relieve my burden while it would devastate her. I have been diagnosed with depression, but none of the medication is working. My wife has been a tremendous support and loves me deeply. Ironically, this almost makes things worse. Unfortunately, while I love her, I am not in love with her. I am still in love with my ex-lover, even though I accept that the affair is over. I wish it wasn't, and wish I could transfer the feelings I have for her back to my wife. How do I begin to rebuild my life?" Now, even though this letter was written anonymously, and some of the details weren't exactly accurate, Mary saw this letter in the newspaper and immediately knew who had written it. She knew that it was Patrick and that it was about her. She confronted Patrick about it, and he outright admitted that he had written the letter, and he told her that his reason for doing it was that he felt he had no one else to confide in about his feelings for her, and that he was brokenhearted and angry that things were going so well for her, and he was basically left with no one and nothing. But writing this letter didn't get him the results he wanted, and Patrick's disturbing pattern of obsession with Mary went on long after she broke up with him, and unfortunately for her, he wasn't quite out of ideas just yet. On February the 4th, 2011, in another bizarre attempt to break up Mary and Bobby's relationship, or maybe to just get Mary back under his control again, Patrick contacted TUSLA, which, if you don't know what TUSLA is, it's a legal entity which combines the Health Service, Children and Family Services, and the National Education Welfare Board to basically respond to domestic abuse, sexual abuse, and basically act as like a child protection agency and to give family support. So it was basically a child welfare agency. He contacted them and he claimed that Mary Lowry was neglecting her children emotionally so that way she could stay out late with her new boyfriend, and she had basically lost control of her family. He claimed that she would leave her children alone at night unsupervised, sometimes for long periods of time, to go out with her new man. He claimed to the social worker that he was, you know, making this complaint, and he was doing this out of the good of his heart because of concern he had for his dear former brother-in-law's children. But again, his latest attempt failed because a social worker from Tulsa investigated the claim and found nothing untoward was going on with Mary or her children. They were well cared for and nothing of concern was happening at their home. So now Patrick was back to square one. Mary and Bobby were still happy together, and nothing he had done to break them up had worked. So, 3 months after the failed child welfare complaints, he began hatching a new plan to get Bobby Ryan out of Mary Lowry's life for good. On June the 2nd, 2011, Bobby called over to Mary's house at around 9 p.m. that evening. He had been at his own house with his daughter-in-law Leanne and his granddaughter Amy, and he'd been lying on the ground playing with Amy, just being the great granddad he was, when all of a sudden Bobby started getting a lot of texts from Mary Lowry. She seemed agitated about something, and he even showed Leanne the texts to get her opinion. So he left Leanne and Amy and he went to Mary's house to see, you know, what was the matter with her. He got into his silver van that he used for DJing. It even had his like Mr. Moonlight logo on the side. And he drove it to Mary's house where they spent the night together. They spent the night listening to music. They woke up the next morning at around 6 a.m. They made love to each other and he left her house by about 6:30 that morning, which was usual. He would usually leave early so that way he could get back to his own house to get his lunch and his work boots before heading to work at the quarry. Now, Mary's house had a big, long kind of winding driveway from the house down to the road. And like a lot of farm driveways in Ireland, it had a cattle grid at the end. If you don't know what a cattle grid is, it's basically a set of very strong metal tubes set over like a deep pit in the ground that deters cattle from going up the driveway, and because it makes like a lot of noise when you stand on it or if you drive over it, like it kind of rattles and makes a noise, so the cattle won't go up a path they're not supposed to, basically. So that morning Mary was in bed and she recalled that it took longer than usual for her to hear Bobby's van drive down the driveway over the cattle grid, because she could usually hear it make noise all the way from inside the house when he would leave in the mornings. And, you know, she kind of thought to herself, like, what's taking him so long? It had been at least 5 minutes, maybe even as long as 10 minutes. But she went on with her morning as normal after that. 2 hours later, by about 8:30 a.m., Mary saw Patrick on her farm and she noticed that he looked, quote, hot and sweaty and bothered looking. But she didn't take too much notice of him and she went on about her usual Friday routine. She took her kids to school as normal and then she took her mother-in-law Rita into town, which she would do every single Friday. Now, but that meant no one was at Mary's farm in Fonagowan for most of the entire morning, giving Patrick Quirk plenty of time to do whatever he wanted there. Patrick knew all of Mary's routines. He knew where she would be that Friday. He knew that the kids would be at school and that she would be in town for a few hours with her mother-in-law, just like every Friday. So he had plenty of time to carry out his plan. Later in the day, the alarm was raised when Bobby failed to show up for work, which was very unlike him. He was a hard worker. He always kept track of time. He wouldn't just skip work. His son, Robert, went to the quarry and he saw that his father's van wasn't there. His daughter, Michelle, tried to tell herself, you know, maybe he took the day off work, which she knew wasn't like him, but she thought maybe it was a possibility. But Michelle started to get more and more worried when she eventually met Mary, who was also worried about Bobby because there was now no sign of him anywhere and neither of them could get in touch with him. Michelle decided to report her father missing, and there was a bulletin put out on the local radio stations asking for help trying to find him. Michelle and Mary went out driving in Mary's car. They went looking around her property, around the local area for any trace of Bobby, and eventually they came across his silver van parked at a car park leading to Kilshane Woods by about that afternoon. Michelle jumped out of Mary's car before she had even stopped driving and ran into the woods, screaming and calling her dad's name, hoping that he could hear her. Now, immediately, Guardian searchers began focusing all their efforts on Kilshane Woods. Search parties were going out. They were searching for a body or a phone or car keys or maybe an item of clothing or a shoe or any kind of clue or evidence as to what happened to Bobby Ryan. They searched Kilshane Woods multiple times and they found nothing to indicate that he was ever there. Now, Michelle was allowed to open her father's van and she immediately noticed two strange things. First, the van was unlocked, which she said her father would never do because it contained all of his DJing equipment, so he would never just park it someplace and leave it unlocked. The second thing that she noticed was the strange way that the driver's seat was left. She knew her dad's seat position, you know, because she would get in and drive his van sometimes. And she noted that the seat this time was pushed really far back, like all the way to the limit, which wasn't normal at all. Her father didn't drive with his seat pushed all the way back like that. So Michelle immediately knew, and she told the police that there was no way that her father was the last person to drive the van to the woods and leave it like that. Now, Patrick heard about the disappearance of Bobby Ryan that evening, and he even took part in some of the searches for Bobby, just because he's so helpful. But what the searchers and investigators didn't know was that Bobby Ryan never left the farmyard at Fonagowan that morning. Meanwhile, at Patrick Quirk's farm in Breenshamore, Breda O'Dwyer, who was working as an artificial inseminator technician, she remembered that this was the first day in 15 years of visiting Patrick's farm to see his cattle and tend to them that she saw him actively working in his milking parlour when she got there at 9:30 a.m. That was unusually late for him. So she thought to herself, something must have really thrown out his schedule this morning. After that, Patrick went to a hotel in Portlaoise later that morning to take his wife Imelda on a treat for her birthday. That's right, you probably forgot about his wife. No, clearly, the day Bobby went missing, he was in a great mood, and he decided to take his wife to a hotel to spend her birthday, and he spent over 600 euros for their two-night stay. The search for Bobby went on, and his family were getting increasingly distraught because they had no idea what happened to him. There were missing persons posters on poles around the local area with Bobby's photo on them, and a missing persons inquiry was opened, and investigators searched Mary's farm with the help of Patrick Quirk, unaware at this time that he had had a previous affair with Mary Lowry. They started searching in the sheds, they searched the land, they searched the slurry pits, they even were searching the nearby farms and ditches and woods in the surrounding area. They asked Patrick, while they were at the farm, were there any other slurry pits or tanks on the land? And he said no, there were only two. And they searched those and they found nothing. There were extensive searches done all around. They looked through the woods, abandoned buildings, but they found nothing of interest. And I just want to interject here and say that there were some problems with the investigation and definitely some system failures that I will talk about later on. But for now, with no sign of Bobby at all, and the kind of worrying way his van had been abandoned in leading into that wooded area, people were beginning to think that perhaps he had left his car and gone into the woods and committed suicide. But after weeks went by since Bobby's disappearance, it was becoming less and less likely that he had committed suicide, because by now, after so many extensive searches, his body would have turned up someplace. Mary was beginning to have suspicions that whatever happened to Bobby hadn't been an accident, and she confessed to a close friend named Catherine Costello that she had had an affair in the past with her brother-in-law, Patrick Quirk, and that she was deeply ashamed about it because she knew it was wrong. Catherine told her that she needed to tell this information to the Gardaí because they were unaware of that part of the story. But Mary was so embarrassed that she didn't want to tell them about the affair. So instead, Catherine went to the Gardaí with the information about the affair herself. But life for Patrick went back to normal. Now that Bobby was out of the way, he was able to continue his pursuit of Mary unhindered. And he even convinced her to spend the night with him at Fitzpatrick's Hotel in Killiney in South Dublin in January of 2012, 8 months after Bobby's disappearance. Now, Mary said that she didn't want to be at the hotel with him, and that she got really drunk and she left early the next morning, and insisted that they didn't rekindle their affair. Even though Bobby was out of the picture, she wanted nothing to do with Patrick. And by March of 2012, over St. Patrick's Day weekend, Mary met a new man named Flor Cantillon, who she started dating. Clearly, you know, she, like I said, had no interest in Patrick. She had now set him aside for a second man, but his infatuation with her continued. And despite saying that he loved her and he loved her and he wanted to be with her, Patrick was definitely starting to get more resentful of Mary. And he began, like, pressuring her to give him money and insisting that she owed him compensation for that infection that his cattle got. But then, in August, Patrick's son, Alan, died in a sudden farming accident. 2 weeks after the funeral, Patrick was texting Mary, accusing her of not supporting him enough and guilt-tripping her, saying things like, quote, "After all I've done for you." Things between them began to get worse. Patrick bumped into Mary's brother Eddie again and told him that Mary was, quote, "a right bitch," and that he would personally remove her from Alan's month's mind mass if she dared to show up to the church. Now, despite saying all of this hateful stuff and being angry at her, Patrick was still very obsessed with Mary. She, however, was clearly getting more and more freaked out by him, and she even believed that he had snuck into her house and stolen her passport so that way she couldn't take her family on a holiday she was planning. So she set up CCTV around her house and I think around the farmyard after someone kept causing her house alarm to go off. At one point, someone had broken into her house by going through a bathroom window, but they hadn't taken anything of value from the house. So police told her that it could have just been local kids up to mischief. But Mary was suspicious that it had been Patrick. And boy, was she right. In December of 2012, Patrick was caught on CCTV snooping around the outside of Mary's house. He was peering into her windows. He also checked her mailbox. And if that wasn't creepy enough, he went over to Mary's washing line and he took her underwear off the line. And then he used a key he had stolen to open her front door. This man that she had broken up with 2 years before was completely stalking her life. I would have been so scared if I was Mary when I saw that CCTV footage. So anyway, he tries to open the door, and the house alarm goes off again. So the police come out to the house reacting to the alarm. They searched around, but they found nothing, and they presumed that it had been a false alarm. Somehow, Patrick managed to disappear while they were checking the house, and then he reappeared on CCTV when they left. Now, they told Mary, oh, it was just a false alarm, you've got nothing to worry about. But she didn't trust that it was just a false alarm, so she had one of her sons check back over the CCTV footage of that day. And that's when she discovered it was actually Patrick Quirk who had set off the alarm. And on going back further, she realized that this was not the first time he had been snooping around her house. Now, after this whole incident, Mary was completely done. She was at the end of her rope with Patrick. He had stolen her keys, her underwear, her passport. He was stalking her and scaring her. But she was also conscious of the fact that he had just lost his son, and his whole family were still grieving. So she didn't want to make a big scene about the way he was, like, harassing her. But she, you know, didn't want to let him keep carrying on what he was doing. So she went to her solicitor and she asked the solicitor to kindly insist that Patrick terminate his lease at her farm for both of their sakes. Now, initially, Patrick wanted her to compensate him in return for cancelling his lease early. But in the end, he eventually agreed to be done with Mary's farm by early July 2013. However, they ran into each other one last time on April 29th in 2013. And this was not a pleasant meeting. Mary was angry and annoyed at him for snooping around her house, and she basically called him the C word and mocked him for stealing her underwear. But this just made Patrick more vindictive and hateful of her. And I'll leave it up to you if you think what happens next was just a coincidence. On the very next day after this nasty confrontation between the two of them, on the 30th of April 2013, Patrick Quirk was working at Mary Lowry's farm when he urgently needed water to mix with the slurry in one of the slurry tanks. If you don't know what slurry is, it's basically cow manure that gets stored and diluted with water in a slurry tank, and then farmers will then spray it on their grass and crops as a fertilizer. He knew that there had been a leak from the water mains a few weeks earlier, and that there had been water kind of running in to this old unused tank. So he thought he could just take the water from that tank and use it for the slurry. Now, I need to explain a bit about this tank so you can imagine it. It was kind of behind the milking parlor. It was below ground, so it was not immediately obvious to the naked eye. This tank measured 3.6 meters by 1.8 meters, and it was 1.6 meters deep. So in feet, it was almost 12 feet by 6 feet, and then about 5 feet deep. Now, this runoff tank, it could only be accessed by removing two very, very heavy concrete slabs which covered the tank. And the crazy thing is that these slabs each weighed 280 pounds. So, again, moving them was not easy at all. The rest of the tank was basically poured concrete. So, what I'm trying to say is this tank was very difficult to access. You wouldn't even know that it was there unless you knew this farm layout very well. And it had like 280 pound concrete slabs on top of it. So it wasn't going to be accessed very easily either. In fact, Mary Lowry didn't even know about this runoff tank, and it was on her land. Patrick said that he then used a shovel to prise open one of those really heavy concrete slabs, just a few inches, just enough that he could put a pipe down into the tank to suck up the liquid. As he was watching the water level in the tank go down, he suddenly noticed something odd looking inside the tank. He said he then used his hands to push aside the second slab. I just want to remind you, that slab almost weighed 300 pounds, but he was able to move it with his hands, apparently. And he said that he saw inside this tank what he thought were human remains. So, what does he do next? Well, he calls his wife Imelda, of course. He doesn't call the police. Or even Mary Lowry, the person who actually owns this property. No. He calls Imelda because apparently she's really great in a crisis. He told her on the phone that he didn't want to say what he had found or what had happened over the phone, but he told her to get over to Mary's farm immediately. So Imelda shows up to the farm and Patrick tells her what he thinks he found in the tank. She goes, she takes a look, and then she calls in the discovery of the human remains inside this runoff tank. They were told by the police not to touch anything else, and the officers were immediately dispatched to the scene. Inspector Padraig Powell was the first officer at the scene. When he arrived, he saw Patrick Quirk and his wife Imelda sitting on a wall on the property. Patrick was pretty quiet, but he brought the inspector over to the tank where he had located the remains. Now, the first thing that Inspector Powell noticed was that Patrick's hands and clothes were extremely clean, considering he said that he'd been working with slurry that morning. Slurry, it's very messy, it's stinky, it's like a dark green, brown colour, like it's, you know, you touch it once and it gets everywhere. So he was surprised that this man who had been supposedly doing this very like dirty, messy job on the farm was so clean. He was immaculate looking. But his first priority was to actually look at the tank and seeing whether or not it was actually human remains in the tank and, you know, not some kind of other animal remains or something else. So he wasn't really interested in talking to Patrick a lot at first. Inspector Powell said that at first he couldn't see very well, but, you know, he'd been standing up looking into the tank in the ground. So he decided instead to kneel down over the tank and he used a flashlight, and that's when he could see what appeared to be the outline of human remains lying face down at the bottom of the tank. But again, the visibility wasn't great because the body was covered in, you know, what appeared to be some kind of algae, slime stuff. And you have to remember, like, there were all sorts of liquids from the farm draining into this tank. There was water, muck, cow waste. So it was just very gross, as you can probably imagine. Now, for some reason, despite discovering human remains, Deputy State Pathologist Dr. Khalid Jaber wasn't able to attend the scene immediately that day. Apparently, he was asked to attend the scene and he refused to come. So it was up to the forensic investigators and the police to basically find a way to drain this tank and carefully remove the body. So they actually used like a mini digger to pry off the other concrete slab covering the runoff tank. And when the body was being removed, they tried to, you know, carefully move the body onto this kind of tarp and lift it from the tank. Unfortunately, the arm separated from the body because it was so badly decomposed. Dr. Khalid Jaber performed a post-mortem the day after the remains were found, and it was then determined that this was indeed the body of Bobby Ryan. When Michelle got the phone call that there had been a body found at the Fonagown farm, she felt immediately paralysed. As broken as she was about her father's disappearance, hearing that news completely broke her. After the Ryan family were able to take Bobby's remains back and finally have him laid to rest, Michelle spoke at his funeral about the profound tragedy of her father's murder, and she said that he was the life and soul of their family, but she also demanded justice for him. She said, quote, "God didn't take Daddy away from us. Someone else who was playing God did that." The Gardaí now had a murder case on their hands, and they were immediately suspicious of Patrick Quirk. They had learned and gathered a lot of evidence about his personal life and his very volatile relationship with Mary. They learned that he'd been going to counselling because he was so down about the end of their relationship, and they learned that he wasn't sleeping and he'd been prescribed medication to help him, but that it wasn't working. He was becoming obsessed about the breakup and he wasn't able to get over that fact. Then there were all the obvious problems with Patrick's story. First of all, an engineer named Mark Riley inspected and tested the capacity of this runoff tank, and he said that it was actually so porous that it wasn't capable of holding water anymore. When he tested the tank, he filled it with 21,000 litres of water, and the water basically started running out immediately as soon as it went in. Eventually, it only held about 4,000 litres. Plus, that April, the month when the body was found, it had been a very dry month, so there wasn't actually even more than a few inches worth of sludgy, dirty water in this old tank anyway, so there was no way Patrick would have been able to suction out enough water from there to use it for the slurry like he claimed he wanted to. Secondly, the visibility in the tank was really severely limited. The officers decided to reconstruct what Patrick said he saw, and they determined it would have been impossible to see anything in the bottom of that tank based on what he said happened. But, unfortunately, the Gardaí hadn't consulted an engineer or taken many measurements like, you know, considering lighting conditions and things like that when they did this. So it wasn't a very reliable reconstruction, and therefore it couldn't be used as evidence against him. But, regardless, a seasoned investigator who knew what a decomposing body looked like, even he could barely make it out of the bottom of the tank when he was literally like kneeling over it and using a flashlight. So it's very unlikely that Patrick Quirk, untrained in the field of dead bodies, could somehow make out exactly what that was at the bottom of this tank from where he was standing. But anyway, the investigators set about questioning Patrick, but oddly enough, he was very prepared for their questions, and he quickly began trying to shift suspicion away from himself and onto Mary instead. He denied having anything to do with how Bobby Ryan's body ended up in the runoff tank. Instead, he started posing questions to the police as to, you know, isn't it suspicious that Mary was the last person to see him alive? And, you know, why was she so unclear about whether it took Bobby 10 minutes or 2 minutes to leave her driveway on the morning he disappeared? He also thought it was suspicious how quickly she and Michelle just happened to find Bobby's car. He tried to tell the investigators that Mary didn't really seem to care much about Bobby's disappearance. He said, you know, she really couldn't care less about it. And he also told them that Mary did know about the runoff tank on her property. Once again, he was trying to point the blame and suspicion at her. But even in doing this, his jealousy and his spitefulness was very obvious. And he made a few very careless mistakes in the run-up to the body's discovery. Now, think back a little bit and remember how Mary had insisted that he end his lease on her farm in July. So this basically put him on a deadline. Patrick knew that if anyone else rented the farm after him, they could possibly come across the body in the tank. So he knew he had to speed up his whole staged discovery. And because of this new urgency, a few weeks before he came across the body, he made a major, major mistake. So, a few weeks before he came across the body, this staged discovery, Patrick had secretly opened the tank to check on Bobby's remains. He probably wanted to make sure that they were visible or, you know, they hadn't sank or something like that. So that way he could come up with a story for how he suddenly saw this body. What he didn't realize was, until now, Bobby's body had been sealed up in this tank. Imagine it was almost like a sarcophagus, like a tomb, with those two massive concrete slabs on top. It had sealed the tank completely. There was also, on top of the two slabs, a thick layer of mud and muck from the farmyard, which had made a perfect seal on top. It completely protected the body from the elements. And so when Patrick, you know, washed away the mud, cracked open one of the slabs to look inside, flies had gotten into the tank. So forensic entomologist Dr. John Manlove, who was an insect expert, said that he saw common blowfly larvae in the body's chest cavity and on the back of the body. He said this type of fly can detect the smell of rotting flesh long, long, long before a human or even a dog might notice it, and that these flies like to lay their eggs, usually in orifices or open wounds, so that way when the eggs hatch, they can use the flesh of the corpse as a food source. He said that these larvae were all at the exact same stage of development, meaning they had infested the body at least 11 days prior to the discovery. He also said that the small amount of larvae and the lack of any other insects present on the body indicated to him that the body had not been exposed to the air for a long period of time. He explained that this thick layer of sludge on top of the sealed tank would have made it absolutely impossible for any flies to get in or get out of that tank. So someone had to have deliberately washed away the mud, opened the slabs for these flies to get into the body. He concluded by saying, based on the fly larvae that he studied from the body, that April 30th, the day that the body was discovered, was definitely not the first time someone had opened that tank, but in fact, it would have had to have been opened a few weeks earlier for the flies to get in there. The Gardaí believed that on the morning Bobby went missing, Patrick had seen him leaving Mary's house, and that he possibly stopped him further down the driveway, where he seriously assaulted him, or possibly even hit him with his car. Then, later on, he put his body into the runoff tank and sealed it up. Since that day, Patrick had been preparing for the day that the body would be revealed. He had also been preparing to shift as much of the blame off himself as possible, as I mentioned earlier. So when his house was searched on the 17th of May, about 3 weeks after the body's discovery, there was like this note found in a notebook that kind of had written in it all the things that Patrick had said in an interview about the situation with Mary Lowry and Bobby Ryan's disappearance, as if he had almost been preparing a script of what he would say about the discovery of the body. Also during the house search, the investigators seized computers and hard drives from Patrick's home, because some of the senior investigators predicted that they would find internet searches relating to human decomposition on the computers, and they were right. Do you remember that day that Patrick was caught on CCTV snooping around Mary's house? Well, on that exact same day, he went home and he Google searched, quote, human body decomposition timeline. And he looked at multiple articles relating to how the human body decomposes after death. And this wasn't the first time he had made these searches. In the months before, he was looking up similar things, as well as reading an article about DNA evidence and the limitations of DNA. When the investigators asked him about these very, you know, unusual searches on his computer, and they wanted him to explain what he was looking up that stuff for, Patrick had the gall to try and say that he was reading about a body's decomposition because his son, Alan, had recently died and he was, you know, preoccupied with the thought of his son's body. He tried to use his dead son as an excuse, maintaining that was the reason he was looking up things about human decomposition, It had nothing to do with the dead body of his rival that was decomposing in the runoff tank. But, using that excuse, he messed up again. Because the investigators knew when Alan died, in August of 2012. And they also had the dates and times of all of his internet searches. So they knew that he'd been looking up all this stuff in July, before Alan ever passed away. And when, you know, they said that to him, he had nothing to say in response. But, as if the internet searches weren't bad enough, on a hard drive found in Patrick Quirk's home, it was found that he had been secretly recording Mary. And he'd been recording audio of him and Mary having sex. They also found that he had been secretly recording him and his wife Imelda having sex too, which just further showed like his weird sexual proclivities. He had also began secretly recording Mary's conversations with other men, including her new boyfriend named Flor. And, you know, she had no idea about any of this, so this was really frightening to learn. Despite repeatedly claiming in Garda interviews that he was happy for Mary to be in a relationship with Bobby and that he wasn't jealous of Bobby at all this was completely contradicted by his actions and his repeated attempts to break them up. Now, even though Patrick had gotten away with the murder of Bobby Ryan for 22 months at this stage, because, you know, he had planned it all so carefully, he made sure that no one would be at the farm that morning. He sealed his body away in this unused tank that nobody even really knew existed. But it was his internet searches and his need to check on the state of the body before revealing it, plus his downright ridiculous attempts to point blame at Mary, that actually reflected all the suspicion back on him. By June of 2014, detectives arrested Patrick Quirk for the killing of Bobby Ryan, and Patrick pleaded not guilty to the murder charge. Now, because of the extensive decomposition of the body and the lack of a murder weapon, the evidence against Patrick was largely circumstantial, but it was very strong circumstantial evidence. Despite there being no smoking gun, DNA evidence or fingerprint evidence found, the prosecution felt that they had enough evidence to show that Patrick's jealousy was out of control and he killed Bobby Ryan as a result. At the trial, the prosecutor, his name was Michael Bowman, he flat out said there is no smoking gun in this case, but he put forward all the details about Patrick's obsession with Mary. He described the anonymous letter he wrote, the fact that Patrick was stalking her. The court heard all about the calls that he placed to Tulsa claiming that Mary was neglecting her children to be with her new boyfriend. All of this showed that leading up to Bobby's murder, Patrick was not a man in control and he was on the edge of doing something crazy. It showed that he was unhinged and that he was very, very vindictive. Bowman explained that Patrick's motive was that Bobby was his rival in Mary's life and that he needed to get Bobby out of the picture so that way he could be with Mary again. Now, to put forward all of this evidence, Mary Lowry's private life was very much put on public display in a way that's not as common in Ireland as it is in other countries. Mary had to testify for the prosecution, and she was heavily cross-examined by the defence. They were pulling any inconsistencies in her statements. For example, early on in the investigation, when Bobby was still a missing person, she told the police that she felt Patrick was a good person who had her best interests at heart. But then, they kind of said to her, like, what made you change your tune all of a sudden? They suggested that she was the vindictive one who was now trying to paint Patrick in a bad light any chance she got. They also asked her if she had rekindled her relationship with Patrick after Bobby's disappearance, and she said no, that he would pressure her and pester her to be with him, but she insisted that she didn't want anything to do with him anymore. Despite this, she did admit eventually that he had pressured her into staying at a hotel with him that one night I mentioned earlier. She said that night She went to the hotel with him. She got very drunk, that they hadn't been intimate at all, and that she really only went there to try and get Patrick to stop pestering her. Also called to testify at the trial were Martin Lowry's two brothers. So Martin, if you remember, that's Mary's deceased husband. His two brothers testified to their knowledge about this unused runoff tank. They testified that the tank was constructed during the 1970s and that the only people who knew of its existence on the farm were the two of them, their brother Martin, obviously, and Patrick Quirk. Now, in every murder case, the evidence from the victim's body plays a huge part. But even though Bobby's remains were found, the prosecution was at a disadvantage because, if you remember, on the day that the body was found, the state pathologist, Khalid Jaber, didn't attend on the day of the discovery, and he didn't supervise the removal of the body from the tank. He only performed the post-mortem the day after. Then, when Dr. Jaber was invited to testify about the post-mortem at the trial, he declined to testify about it. It would have been a much more beneficial thing for the prosecution had Jaber supervised the removal and testified at the trial. Because, I guess, if the pathologist doesn't go to the scene to see it for themselves, and then later some other issues get brought up, they're not really able to answer questions or, you know, explain what happened because they weren't there themselves. So because of this, Dr. Jaber's autopsy report had to be reviewed by other state pathologist peers. The cause of death was thought to be blunt force trauma because of the many multiple fractures to Bobby's skull and face. However, the defense put forward their own pathologist who believed the death of Bobby Ryan was actually from a vehicular impact. However, a vehicular impact to the skull usually shows one fracture to the skull caused by it hitting the ground, not multiple fractures the way Bobby had. There was also important testimony from Breda O'Dwyer, who was that artificial insemination tech, who was an eyewitness and placed Patrick Quirk at his farm the day that Bobby went missing. If you remember, he was maintaining that he had just been milking his cows the morning Bobby went missing and that he'd been home the entire time. But when she showed up to the farm and saw that he was still milking his cows at 9:30 a.m., she thought that was really, really late. She said normally by that time, he would have been cleaned up, the milking parlour would have been cleaned out and spotless, and he would have been going back to his home to have breakfast. This was critical testimony because it showed Patrick had used this window of time on that Friday morning to kill Bobby and clean up what he had done, which caused his usual milking schedule to fall way behind, which made his alibi completely disintegrate. The court also heard the testimony from Dr. John Manlove about that blowfly larvae found on the body, which showed that the tank had been opened before this supposed discovery was made by the accused. This was really important information, and it demonstrated that someone knew that the body had been in the tank before it was ever publicly discovered on April the 30th, 2013. It also bolstered the prosecution's claim that Patrick killed Bobby, then put him in the tank and staged this whole discovery. Then, on the 22nd of March, in the trial, the prosecution had kind of been building up to this moment. This was the day that they finally showed the court all of Patrick Quirk's gruesome internet searches. The search of the hard drive not only showed that he'd been like searching, you know, the timeline of a body's decomposition, it also showed that around this same time, someone using the computer had been watching YouTube videos on a channel called The Body Farm and Beyond, which shows and discusses human remains, skin slippage, and DNA analysis. The amount of searches were demonstrated to the court, and the details that were looked up were shown. So it was very obvious that whoever had been making these searches had a very keen and very grisly interest on the subject of human decomposition. Now, putting this information with the blowfly evidence showed to the jury that Patrick had been very concerned about the level of decomposition of Bobby's remains in the tank. And so he had decided to open the tank in the weeks before the discovery to check the decomposition progress. Many people claimed later that this was the day in court that really damned Patrick Quirk. His internet searches were actually the smoking gun for the prosecution. But not all of the evidence found on the computer was shown to the jury. Google searches about other high-profile murder cases and other high-profile murderers in Ireland were left out. One internet search was an article that said, quote, "How Joe O'Reilly Committed the Perfect Murder." That didn't get brought into court. There were also the secretly recorded sex audios with Mary. That was excluded because the judge thought they were just way too prejudicial. The circumstantial evidence showed that Patrick Quirk was the only person who had access to that runoff tank and the motive to kill Bobby Ryan. Now, as you can imagine, the gruesome details of Bobby's injuries at the trial were very painful for his loved ones to have to hear. In one horrific moment during the trial, a photograph of Bobby's skeleton that was taken when it was freshly removed from the tank and it was still covered in, you know, blackened filth, it was accidentally displayed on the courtroom monitor screen. And Michelle and her mother were just absolutely left sobbing after seeing this. Robert, who was Bobby's son, he said that he would just sit and close his eyes and hoped that when he opened them again, that none of this was really happening. And as for Robert and Michelle, they were tormented imagining what their father's last moments alive were like. They would have nightmares and fears that their father was still alive when he was put into that tank and that he had spent his last moments screaming for help or scraping the walls of the tank trying to get out of that black hole in the ground. They worried that he had been put in there alive and he'd just been left to starve to death. And because of the, you know, pretty decomposed state of the body, it was basically a skeleton inside in the tank, they would never know if that was the case or not. So they had all these really disturbing, horrific fears going on in their head, wondering what their poor dad endured. But throughout the entire trial, Patrick was very stoic. None of this seemed to get to him. However, there was one day when his calm demeanor slipped in the courtroom. On that day, Jack Lowry, who was one of Mary Lowry's sons, was giving his testimony. Patrick didn't even bother to look at Jack when he entered the court. But when he did give evidence, Jack was asked what he thought of Patrick Quirk. And Jack said he had no problem with Patrick, that they had spent a lot of time together at the farm, and that he and Patrick's son Alan had had a really good bond together. This promoted a very surprisingly strong reaction from Patrick Quirk. He was very obviously fighting back his emotions, but it got the better of him. His lips were trembling, he was crying hearing this information. And that was his first display of any real emotion this entire time through the whole trial. Now, you might find it a bit hard to believe, but Imelda, Patrick's wife, stood by him through the entire trial. Now, she sat there and she heard every single word. She heard all about her husband's sick obsession with her brother's wife, and she still stayed with him. She saw that anonymous letter that he wrote to the newspaper where he said he wished that he could transfer his feelings for Mary to his wife, that he didn't love her anymore. But, you know, despite hearing about all of this stuff, the whole affair, Imelda didn't let any of her pain show. She would just arrive with Patrick to the courtroom every morning and she would sit alone. When there was a break in the, you know, the trial for the day, they would go off and they would have lunch together, or they would go for a walk together. It's just really hard to believe. Like, I don't know. I don't know what kind of a hold he had over her, but like, that's crazy to me. Now, the trial was finally wrapping up after almost 3 months, and the jury were left with two options: to either convict Patrick Quirk of murder or acquit him entirely. The 12 men and women of the jury had to make this choice. And, you know, looking at Patrick Quirk, he's a very average, typical-looking 50-year-old Irish farmer. He doesn't look like a man capable of murder on the surface. But, thankfully, on the 1st of May 2019, the jury found Patrick Quirk guilty by a majority vote of 10-2, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. However, the conviction was thrown into doubt after the Supreme Court ruled earlier this year in 2023 that the seizure of a computer from Patrick Quirk's house was unlawful as it wasn't specified in the search warrant. This was the computer that was used to search for the info on the human decomposition, and it was a key piece of evidence. Basically, from what I can understand, the Gardaí had a warrant to seize items from the house. You know, if they found a knife, they could seize a knife. If they found a computer, they could seize the computer. But the warrant didn't specify forensically searching the computer after they had seized it. So Patrick's lawyers immediately wanted a retrial. However, it was determined that the computer evidence should not be excluded because, quote, the Gardaí executed the warrant that was lawful in circumstances where the trial judge found they acted in good faith. It would offend any sense of logic to find it was a deliberate and conscious violation of a constitutional right. And in the end, the court upheld the murder conviction. So, he was in prison. He's in prison to this day. But to this day, Imelda still visits him regularly at Mountjoy Prison. I don't know. Nothing on earth. I don't know. I'd be dead before I'd go see a man in prison who was literally obsessed with my sister-in-law. Could you imagine? That's a different level of crazy. As for Mary Lowry, her troubles have continued. As of January 2023, she was back in court, this time facing charges of reckless driving that unfortunately claimed the life of 51-year-old Patrick Connolly, who was out on a charity motorbike outing with his son on December 28th, 2021. Mary hit them with her car, and they were both rushed to hospital following the accident, where Mr. Connolly died 5 days later. She's been charged with driving her car, quote, without due care and attention. But that trial, as far as I can tell, is still waiting to be concluded. I think it's still ongoing. Bobby Ryan's family, they were finally able to get justice for their beloved father, and a weight was lifted after the guilty verdict was upheld. But ultimately, they'll never be able to get him back. And in their words, Patrick Quirk left them with nothing. And unfortunately, that's the very sad end of today's case. This was a wild one. You'll have to let me know what you guys think. A lot of people seem to like cast suspicion at Mary, and they question how much she knew and things like that. But honestly, like, do I think she did all the right things in life? No. I definitely think she regretted ever having an affair with Patrick, for sure. And I also think that it was really messed up that she was more worried about bringing shame on herself by admitting their affair than like doing the right thing and admitting it to the police, which would have helped the investigation way earlier on. Like, that was awful. Like, there's no way of getting around it. But you can also understand why she was embarrassed and ashamed. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag there. But a lot of people seem to think like that she was suspicious, that she just stumbled across his body at Kilshane Woods, or not his body, his car, I should say, at Kilshane Woods and all that sort of thing. But, you know, I find it very hard to believe that if she had ever had any idea that Bobby's body was, you know, stored in that tank, I can't imagine her living at that house for 2 years, knowing that he was only like 100 feet away in this horrible, dank, underground storage tank. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I don't know. I think Patrick, he's the villain in today's case. Like, there's no way around it. Like, he was messed up from start to finish. He didn't care how many people's lives he messed up to get what he wanted. He didn't care about his own kids, his own wife. He didn't care about Bobby, his kids. He didn't care about Mary, even though he claimed he loved her. He was like ruining her life every chance he got. So anyway, let me know what you guys think. Thanks for listening to the case, and I'll talk to you all soon. Bye. If you'd like to see any of the interesting images I found while researching this case, please follow along to my Instagram account at Dark Emerald Podcast. Feel free to like, share, send me a message. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the case. Bye.